You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You can get a decent cup of joe pretty much anywhere in LA, so choosing where to buy your soy latte or double cap is about more than just the taste.
Coffee quality aside, the vibe of the place, for me, affects how that coffee tastes. So, like, I'll go to a spot where the coffee may not be that good, but the vibe is right, the energy is great, and I'll just continue going back there because I'm like, I'm comfortable here, I love it, and like, to me, that makes it a good coffee shop.
That's Michelle Johnson. She's a barista and a business consultant. On her blog, The Chocolate Barista, she writes about how the vibes in coffee shops can welcome or exclude different people. Today, she's in the West Adams neighborhood at Highly Likely Cafe on Jefferson Boulevard with KCRW's Jerome Campbell. Now, this is the first of three stops that Michelle and Jerome are making on a caffeine-fueled tour of South Los Angeles. They're going to coffee shops in so-called transitional neighborhoods that have all opened within the past couple of years. And they're looking to answer this question: who are these spaces designed to welcome through their doors? In these historically black neighborhoods, how do these new businesses signal to their changing communities who belongs and who does not? Jerome picks up the story from here.
Almost everything, and Highly Likely, is custom picked.
I love our terrazzo tables that we designed. We had those custom made from a fabricator in San Diego. The terrazzo tables are one of my favorite things.
Alex Matthews is a co-owner of Highly Likely. A big green parrot is painted on the cafe's white-coated brick facade outside. It stands out among the block of brick workshops and auto shops in either direction. A playlist featuring SWV and Lil Wayne hums in the background. The culmination of these choices leaves Michelle uneasy.
I don't know about this. Like, this feels a little weird. It's like they want to bring that culture and vibe to the space without having the actual people there. And I'm like, I'd rather just take Tame Impala if you're going to do all that.
A feeling underscored by a more visible fact.
We're in a black neighborhood and there aren't that many black people in here. And I don't know where these white people came from. I really don't.
Recent U.S. Census data shows almost 80% of the people living in West Adams, Baldwin Hills, and Lamart Park are Latinx or black. But inside the shop on this day, at least 75% of the people are white. Alex Matthews says he designed the space to have an authentic international feel.
We always knew that Highly Likely was going to be something slightly more European looking.
Matthews and his wife opened this shop in 2018. They recently moved to West Adams, and he says some of the cafe's patrons are also recent transplants because of its affordable home prices. Matthew says the area was the perfect place to build a cafe because it's near the Expo Line train and because of what he calls the area's neighborhood feel. Although he also recognizes that his cafe is assigned to some local people, that the feeling may go away.
I think there's definitely an element of, you know, if you've grown up here and you've been here your whole life, to suddenly see something like Highly Likely open in a neighborhood that typically they probably would just not have even considered being, you know, something. I think it's probably like an eyebrow raise. You're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that.
It's a very interesting time being black in this cafe during this gentrification process. It's painful.
That's Myra Hassan. She works at Highly Likely. She says the cafe gives her mixed emotions.
And especially like experiencing the dynamic of like certain white people coming in and feeling the feeling of entitlement and having to overhear certain conversations talking about, oh, they're glad that all the black people are leaving and they're taking over the, you know, neighborhood, or experiencing the bitterness of black people coming into the cafe and just being angry at me. And I didn't even do anything. Like, they're mad at the prices. They're mad at the music. They're mad at how it's mostly white people in here.
Hassan lives in Inglewood, but she grew up visiting her grandmother who lives in West Adams. She says when she was a kid, her parents told her it wasn't safe to walk past the street where the cafe is now. Hassan loves to see money invested in the area, but she's conscious of who gets those dollars and how their influence changes the neighborhood.
It was a little bittersweet because Black people don't own it, to be honest, you know, but I mean, it's nice to just see some quality in the neighborhood for once.
Michelle Johnson says ownership is a big deal for local coffee shops because of the role they play in the community. They represent an investment in the neighborhood. And if they do well, are old-timers reaping the benefits or newcomers? To see an example of a local Black-owned coffee shop, Michelle and I check out Hot and Cool Cafe, just 5 minutes away in Lamert Park. The shop sits on the same block as the Black-owned SO1 bookstore and the California Jazz and Blues Museum. And it does not have a European feel.
I think what I really, really, really enjoy about Black-owned spaces is that they make damn sure you know it's Black. Like, they want you to know. And I love it. Like, the Al Green records and the Whitney Houston, the art on the wall and the color palette and just like the African-inspired art pieces and like the wicker chairs and stuff like that. Like, that's straight up out of grandma's spot for sure. I love that.
Anthony Jolly owns Hot and Cool Cafe, and he says all the decorating was intentional.
We brought that wave inside when we first opened, and once we did that, the community became invested. Like, there's a Wakanda chair behind me that came from the Pan-African Film Festival. We have couches behind you that was brought in from a customer. This table was brought in. There's a $20,000 grand piano right there that was brought in from a customer. Like, this, there's a, in the corner right there, there's a 100-year-old drum that was brought in from one of our regulars. The community kind of just brought in stuff to create the feel, and I just had to find a place to put it.
Jolly has been running the cafe for 2 years and says it was important to him that everyone in the community feel that they own space, including those who can't afford a cup of coffee.
We don't throw our Black people away. We don't throw people away just because they're having a time of misfortune or they have a mental illness issue that nobody else had the patience to do it. We believe that they can be a part of the aesthetic too.
Also, Michelle points out that if you don't already know your way around a coffee menu, deciding what you want at the register can be awkward. The staff at Hot and Cool knows that.
One of my favorite things about the coffee menu here is that they have the picture that shows like how much milk, or is the Americano, it has like blue for water, and then the espresso, like visual cues and stuff like that are so important. But like, that's not the case at Highly Likely. Like, if I didn't know anything about coffee, you know, I would have to ask, which might be okay for some people, but not a lot of people feel comfortable, you know, going into a space that they already don't know, that doesn't, like, the clientele doesn't look like them, and then having to then ask.
Being Black-owned doesn't always mean welcoming people who are unfamiliar with sophisticated coffee, though. About 15 minutes away in downtown Inglewood, Hilltop Coffee and Kitchen just opened a new coffee drinking palace. It's across the street from Stevie Wonder's radio station, KJLH, near Inglewood City Hall and Courthouse. The barista greets us before we make it past the entrance.
Did y'all get For Here cups yet? Or is Eric still playing games?
Never, we don't have them.
So, yep,
he's still playing still games.
In her role as a coffee business consultant, Michelle actually trained the people behind the bar. An order of avocado toast and an oat latte later, Michelle points out there's more than one way for a coffee shop to do Black-owned.
The art and design elements of Hot and Cool are like way more in your face. Like, this is Black, I'm Black. You're gonna know that this is Black. And here it's a lot more subdued and it's just like hints towards it. And this just like makes me feel like, coming in here makes me feel like this is like the Black coffee shop for people with money. It's just, I keep coming to that, like.
So it's that sense of pride and almost luxury, but like, again, approachable.
That's AJ Rolland. He's a co-owner of Hilltop, which has HBO producer and actor Issa Rae as an investor. Rolland says the cafe's aesthetics are a mix of Inglewood and Soho House, an exclusive members-only club in West Hollywood. He points out what he calls African and Mayan prints on different rugs and chairs in the space. There's gold accents and leather chairs too. He underscores these elements with self-care phrases scattered around the shop.
We have our signature Good Vibes Only pink neon sign. As you walk down the back staircase here, you'll see a little Easter egg that says, "Don't forget to breathe." If you subtly look up, you'll see this "Keep Your Head Up" sign. If you choose to keep your head up and walk with your head up, it's an ode to Tupac.
Michelle says these do feel reflective of the community around the shop, but they also seem to be doing something more.
Well, to be honest, I feel like there's definitely a level of authenticity here, but also there's like a money motivation behind it as well.
And it makes her wonder if this place comes with a cost to the community.
Can a Black-owned coffee shop gentrify a neighborhood? I feel like out of all the places we went to today, like Hilltop Inglewood would probably be a place that I would think of like a nice coffee shop, still Black-owned, but definitely still a marker of like this area going through gentrification. I still find that gentrification is like a hard thing to grapple with. When you take race out of it and you only have Black people, but now you have class, and I'm like, it's still not a good thing. But at the same time, it's still a nice thing that I think that Black people deserve.
Michelle says it's on consumers to look past a good vibe and see if a local coffee shop truly serves them. Because when you spend your money in a cafe, you're creating the vibes you want to see in your own neighborhood. For KCRW, I'm Jerome Campbell.
Well, coming up, a couple of questions we're going to ponder. A new journalism site focusing on tech takes off. Will it have different fortunes? And later, we know now that the Astros cheated. So were the Dodgers robbed? You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Welcome back to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You know, 2019 was a tough year for the media landscape. Again, an estimated 7,000 jobs were lost and many publications went dark all across the country, including right here in our own backyard. Think OC Weekly or Pacific Standard Magazine. So it is an interesting time to launch a new publication, but that is exactly what Zillow co-founder Spencer Raskoff is doing. Last week, he announced he's starting a new site called .LA that'll be reporting on the greater LA tech scene. And Spencer Raskoff is here right now to talk about it. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Media publications are really struggling these days. What made you want to launch this new one in such a climate?
Yeah, well, that is the interesting thing about being a founder of companies is usually people think you're kind of crazy and your timing is off. But I like our chances. You know, the LA tech scene is really booming right now, and we're about to have an explosive decade. And one of the missing ingredients was that steady drumbeat of local journalism to cover the LA tech community. So that's the hole that .LA looks to fill. And as you point out, you're right, it is a tough climate to be building a media business. But I think if you have hyper-local focused journalism on a specific vertical such as tech, where there's a lot of important decisions being made about that topic and a lot of money being spent in and around it, I think we can build a good business at .LA through sponsorships and events and really carve out a profitable business.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask you when you talk about sponsorships or the way you make money in this new realm. And I think newspapers have been trying to figure this out and wrap heads around it for some time now, ever since the advent of the internet. You know, how do you make money in a situation like this? I mean, are you talking about events where you have ticketed events and people pay to come see things? Do they pay? Are you going to have a paywall? How will that work?
So for digital journalism, it's pretty difficult to survive just on online advertising, especially if you're in such a niche as just covering LA tech, where the size of the audience won't be that large. So we thought a lot about whether to have a paywall and decided that that wasn't the right approach because that doesn't help our mission. Our mission is really to try to build community in and around LA tech. And so the best way to do that is actually to have great journalism complemented by an events business. And so we'll be building out large events, small events, sponsored dinners, hosted workshops, a whole variety of things to bring the LA tech community together and also to pay for our journalism at .LA.
The LA Times is reporting that you guys are being funded by venture capital investment, including investment from the Tinder co-founder, Sean Rand, former Twitter CEO Dick Costello. You've said, though, that .LA will be committed to unbiased reporting, and it'll be dedicated, obviously, to journalistic integrity. How's that going to work when you've got so many sort of hands in the sauce, if you don't mind my saying?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I certainly set out to raise money from the community that we'll be covering. So the $4 million seed round was funded by the major venture capital firms in LA, many of the major tech founders, some of the tech companies, including Snapchat and the Dodgers and Jam City and others. And these are, of course, companies that we'll be writing about. So there's a strong wall of independence between the business side and the journalism side. Every investor signed on to a journalistic independence and integrity pledge, so they understand exactly what they're getting into. And they know that the only way that .LA can succeed in its mission of helping to advance the LA tech scene is to allow us to be independent and call balls and strikes.
I mean, you talk about a firewall, editorial firewall, but, you know, in journalism, appearance is everything. And if you've got a lot of, as I mentioned, you have a lot of hands in this, you know, the guy who you know, has a link to Twitter may not want a story, a negative story about Twitter on a site that he's helping to fund.
Yeah. I mean, I think all these investors understand that the best way to have .LA succeed is to be independent. And they want .LA to succeed because they know that if we're an independent journalistic site covering LA tech, that will help the overall tech community. So I've set that expectations right up front, and I think our investors understand that. And we see this throughout journalism, where you've got businesses like the New York Times, of course, that has conferences like their Dealbook Conference, which is sponsored by private equity firms, for example, which Dealbook, of course, covers. So I think this is well-worn territory, and our investors have eyes wide open about it.
You've hired Joe Belbruno to be the editor in chief. He's a former entertainment editor for the Times. Will you be overseeing him? What's your role in all of this?
Well, I'm executive chairman and co-founder. I have another co-founder named Sam Adams, former Bloomberg and Reuters person who is the CEO. And Joe is the editor-in-chief, reports to the CEO. So I don't have any editorial control. I'm a shareholder and I'm the executive chairman. But as I say, there is journalistic independence from Joe and his team. They've recruited 7 great reporters from the LA Times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Bloomberg, NPR, and others. And when we launch in late January, we're going to have by far the largest editorial team covering LA tech. So that's the opportunity here, is to raise awareness for what's happening in LA tech. The fact that we have more than 10 venture capital firms now with a couple $100 million under management each, several multi-billion dollar funds, big companies like Snapchat and Cornerstone On Demand, big private companies like Bird and Cloud Kitchen and Goat. I mean, this is a huge tech scene that you wouldn't necessarily know just how big it is because there hasn't been local journalism focused on it.
Spencer Raskoff, co-founder and chair of .LA. Spencer, Godspeed to you. Good luck.
Thanks, sir.
Welcome to LA.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Any Dodgers fan will hear this call by Fox's Joe Buck and be reminded of a big, big hurt.
Here's a ground ball right side, could do it. The Houston Astros are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
The Dodgers had given up 5 runs early in Game 7 of the 2017 World Series, couldn't muster a comeback, and that was that. First time the team had been in the World Series in nearly 3 decades, and they took it to the last game and blew it. So then what do you make of Major League Baseball's findings that the Houston Astros concocted a scheme using video cameras and garbage cans at their home stadium to steal pitching signs? So Astros batters would know then what pitches were coming from Dodger or any other team's pitchers. There was punishment. But a lot of Dodger fans are seething right now, and so is Bill Plaschke, by the way, who writes for the LA Times and has covered the Dodgers, let's just say, for a minute. Hey, Bill.
What's going on, man?
So when does the World Series trophy arrive in LA, and where will the Dodgers put it, Bill?
Yeah, well, I think while I understand why they don't want to give it to the Dodgers didn't win it on the field, there really should be no trophy. There should be no winners because the Dodgers certainly didn't lose it. I think the Astros should be forced to vacate the trophy, give it back, and have that 2017 forever sit blank as a mark of shame for them. However, baseball's not making them do it. I mean, baseball, the Astros, if you think about it, got off pretty easy. If you ask any general manager in the league, any team in the league, would they give up their manager, their general manager, and $5 million for a World Series championship? I think most of them would do it.
Yeah, so the punishment was what? $5 million fine, and they suspended the GM and manager, right, for a year, but then the Astros went ahead and fired both of them.
Right, so they sacrificed them and some draft picks. It's just ridiculous. The whole thing is ridiculous. And the Dodgers, this cheating scandal changed Dodger history forever. It changed our perceptions of the way we view the players. You know, I'm talking about games 3, 4, and 5. Well, games 3 and 5, particularly in Houston during the World Series. If Yu Darvish, who'd been unhittable in the postseason, gives up 4 runs in second inning and gets blown out of game 3, and we're ripping Yu Darvish forever. And then game 5, Clayton Kershaw blows both a 4-run lead and a 3-run lead. And Clayton Kershaw, who had struck out 11 and walked none and pitched brilliantly in game 1 of the series and had a victory. So he was hot. And he got his pitches were all tipped and they whacked them. And so now Clayton Kershaw forever, this added to his narrative that he can't pitch in October. Dave Roberts brought in pitcher after pitcher, just got ripped for it. His whole stature in town dropped. Everything, the perception of how we view the Dodgers, if they had won that year, we would not have been on them like we've been on in the last 2 years. I mean, they've been criticized, you know, in my column in particular, for every little thing because they can't win the big one. The drought's 31 years. They choke under pressure. All that would have been that would no longer have existed, that narrative, if they had won in 2017. And we'll never know now, will we? We'll never know. But we do know that they lost by cheating.
Well, let's talk about the cheating. Like, what did the Astros do? Because I mentioned this was an elaborate scheme that used a video camera in the outfield, and then there were garbage cans, like people banging on garbage cans. Explain a little bit about what that's about.
Yeah, what happens is there's this, every ballpark has a center field feed from television, and you can, you know, look through that center field camera and pick up the catcher's sign, the signs the catchers are giving to the pitcher. Teams aren't allowed to use that feed, of course, but the Astros rigged it up so in a TV in their dugout runway, they could see the Dodger catchers giving signs to the Dodger pitchers. They would decode those signs. It took them a couple innings to decode those signs. Then they would have a guy with a trash can, and they would bang. And then so the hitter would go to the plate. If the trash can was banged once, it was a fastball. Banged twice, it was a curveball, something like that. People have tweeted this out. You could hear the trash can being banged in the background. So a hitter, once they know what's coming, boom, ball game.
What have the Dodgers had to say? I mean, they came out with this pretty nebulous, you know, we're not supposed to comment on things like this, and we've been told to keep our mouths shut, and that's about it. I mean, have you heard anything else from the front office or even behind the scenes?
No, they're furious, of course, but the commissioner has ordered them not to say anything. And I think their statement was issued late last night because they were debating whether to say something or they're furious, but the commissioner's asking to be quiet. So they'll be quiet for now. And baseball players, you know, in general aren't, you know, are the kind that will go along and won't rock the boat. So you won't hear any comments from any other Dodgers, I don't think. But just wait. Time goes on. Things will slip out. The anger will show itself. It has to. Because they feel like they have been cost. Their players have been cost their reputations. The team has been cost millions in revenue. It's just everything. And again, but the biggest thing is this would have gotten the monkey off their back. And they were there, and they have been going through hell for 2 years. They're the most successful, criticized organization in professional sports probably because they get the World Series of the playoffs every year, and we're ripping them because they can't win it. That could have all ended if they had a fair shot. They didn't have a fair shot in 2017, and fans should be furious.
Well, we're going to be talking about it for a long time. Bill Plaschke, sports columnist for the LA Times. Bill, thanks.
Thanks, man.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, composting for the future without all the methane. Next on KCRW, it's DNA with Francis Anderton. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. What do you think about this whole Houston Astros, LA Dodgers thing? We'd love to hear from you. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and for your time. Have yourself a great Tuesday.